to the world with a new sense of connection, we often experience a second wave of feminine spiritual consciousness. We come to recognize the innate holiness of the earth, the sacred dwelling in nature, matter, and body. We understand these things are not only creations of the divine, but manifestations of the divine. We see that nature is a dance, and divine reality is the dancer. In other words, the divine co-inheres all that is. Co-inhere is a fancy word, but is closest to capturing the meaning I intend. To co-inhere means to exist together, to be included in the same thing or substance. As the months went by, I began to embrace a vision in which the fullness of the divine penetrates the whole universe. But I also saw the divine as more than the universe, distinct and unexhausted by it. To see the divine as encompassed by the universe is pantheism. To see the divine as expressed by but also larger than the universe is panentheism, a middle ground between pure pantheism and pure theism. The feminine offers us this middle ground. As I indicated earlier, the feminine carries an old and deeply entwined connection with nature, body, and earth. Women's experience has been largely invested in these things as we go through menstruation, pregnancy, childbirth, and nursing. We've also traditionally been the ones involved in the earthy matters of caring for children, cleaning up bodily excrements, and nursing the sick and dying. If, then, we envision the divine as female, a symbol that incorporates nature, body, and matter, then as a people, we will come to honor the feminine, nature, body, and earth. A divine feminine symbol renders obsolete the old idea that these things are outside the realm of divinity. It begins to shift thousands of years of dualistic thinking, setting up a new mandate for the divinity of the earth and the holiness of the body. That fall, I noticed the phrase divine immanence started turning up a lot in my journal. Patriarchy has majored in divine transcendence, which means separateness from the material universe, being above, beyond, or apart from it. Divine immanence, on the other hand, is divinity here, near, and now, inherent in the material stuff of life. It occurred to me that patriarchy's emphasis on transcendence grew out of a flight from death. It sought to transcend death by transcending body and nature, which inevitably die and decay. To be in a body is to hear the heartbeat of death at every moment, says scholar Andrew Harvey. Is it any wonder, then, that patriarchy fears and negates the feminine? Restoring the feminine symbol of deity means that divinity will no longer be only heavenly, other, out there, up there, beyond time and space, beyond body and death. It will also be right here, right now, in me, in the earth, in this river and this rock, in excrement and roses alike. Divinity will be in the body, in the cycles of life and death, in the moment of decay and the moment of lovemaking. I love this statement by Andrew Harvey. Everyone has known something in lovemaking of the great lovemaking of the universe. Everyone who has ever had one tender orgasm with someone else has known something of the divine. The divine is in everything foaming around everywhere. We're all in connection with it. But we've not been given permission. We've not been taught how to understand our glimpses and how to follow them. The symbol of goddess gives us permission. She teaches us to embrace the holiness of every natural, ordinary, sensual, dying moment. Patriarchy may try to negate body and flee earth with its constant heartbeat of death, but goddess forces us back to embrace them, to take our human life in our arms and clasp it for the divine life it is, the nice, sanitary, harmonious moments, as well as the painful, dark, splintered ones. If such a consciousness truly is set loose in the world, nothing will be the same. It will free us to be in a sacred body on a sacred planet in sacred communion with all of it. It will infect the universe with holiness. We will discover the divine deep within the earth and the cells of our bodies, and we will love her there with all our hearts and all our souls and all our minds. I remember a moment when that happened to me. We were in Crete on the far southern side of the island, gathered on a remote stretch of beach. We'd had a long hike up a mountain, and now, tired and hot, with the sun setting and our feet aching, a few of the women began to peel off their clothes for a swim. The beach was strewn with a billion rocks of all sizes, and I was combing through them at the water's edge when I happened to look up. A number of the women, most over 50, moved toward the sea, picking their way together over the rocks, holding hands to help steady one another. Their bodies were nude, sculpted by long years of life and love. Full breasts, prolapsed breasts, Venus of Willendorf thighs, dimpled thighs, skinny thighs, gray hair, brown hair, puckering veins, silver scars, taut bellies, bellies stretched out from bearing children. They moved together laughing, and I was touched by how beautiful they were. It was like a transubstantiation on the beach, the real presence coming into their flesh. As I grounded myself in feminine spiritual experience, that fall I was initiated into my body in a deeper way. I came to know myself as an embodiment of goddess. This awareness, so crucial to women's development, has been shut away from us. In Christianity, God came in a male body. Within the history and traditions of patriarchy, women's bodies did not belong to themselves, but to their husbands. We learned to hate our bodies if they didn't conform to an ideal, to despise the cycles of menstruation, the curse it was called. Our experience of our body has been immersed in shame. Waking to the sacredness of the female body will cause a woman to enter into her body in a new way, be at home in it, honor it, nurture it, listen to it, delight in its sensual music. She will experience her female flesh as beautiful and holy, as a vessel of the sacred. She will live from her gut and feet and hands and instincts, and not entirely in her head. Such a woman conveys a formidable presence because power resides in her body. The bodies of such women, instead of being groomed to some external standard, are penetrated with soul, quickened from the inside. For this, we need herself. For the body to be considered holy once again, the goddess, the female aspect of the deity, must return. For it is only through a goddess consciousness that matter can be perceived as having a sacred dimension, writes Jean Bolin. The same is true of nature. We also need goddess consciousness to reveal Earth's holiness. Divine feminine imagery opens up the notion that the earth is the body of the divine, and when that happens, the divine cannot be contained solely in a book, church, dogma, liturgy, theological system, or transcendent spirituality. The earth is no longer a mere backdrop until we get to heaven, something secondary and expendable. Matter becomes inspirited. It breathes divinity. Earth becomes alive and sacred, and we find ourselves alive in the midst of her, and forever altered. How are we altered? For one thing, if we discover herself in the earth, we will not be so inclined to rape her forests, pave over her jungles, poison her rivers, dump 50 million tons of toxic waste into her oceans each year, or wipe out whole species of her creatures. Sin becomes defined as refusing to befriend and love the earth, for in doing so, we refuse to befriend and love the divine. This new feminine spiritual consciousness will help us recognize that humans, having special abilities, are responsible to the rest of the earth, not superior to it. We will realize that everything here has a purpose all its own, that its value lies in its own beingness, not in its usefulness or how well it benefits humankind. This means something dramatically new, that the rest of creation is here to be related to, not dominated. In many ways, goddess is a symbol of ecological wisdom, and as we face a massive ecological crisis, this particular symbol becomes timely and important. Passionist priest and geologian Thomas Berry says that when it comes to saving the planet, the return of the feminine is the most important thing happening. Many are saying that we may have no habitable future without her. Berry maintains that to survive, we must reinvent the human. We must reverse our severe alienation from the natural world, which lies at the root of its devastation. Christians have gotten so committed to the Bible, he says, we've lost our capacity to deal with a primary revelation of the divine in the natural world. As Christmas came that year and I thought about the incarnation, I finally took it to its ultimate conclusion. For the first time, I discovered a new and radical incarnation in which the divine comes not only through human form, which the doctrine of Christ revealed, but through the earth as well. Here, as Teilhard de Chardin pointed out, is the second coming of Christ, the birth of the divine within earth and matter. Mystical awakening in all the great religious traditions, including Christianity, involves arriving at an experience of unity or non-dualism. In Zen, it's known as samadhi, the experience of the mind no longer divided against itself. When our nature is no longer divided against itself, the inner splits are healed and we see earth and spirit as one. Transcendence and immanence are not separate. The divine is one. The dancer and all the dances are one. The Christian mystic Hildegard of Bingen reflected this when she wrote about the divine as a spirit Sophia filling the cosmos. I, the highest and fiery power, have kindled every living spark, and I have breathed out nothing that can die. I flame above the beauty of the fields. I shine in the waters, in the sun, the moon, and the stars. I burn. And by means of the airy wind, I stir everything into quickness with a certain invisible life which sustains all. I, the fiery power, lie hidden in these things, and they blaze from me. And Mechthild of Magdeburg, another Christian mystic, confessed, "The day of my awakening was the day I saw and knew I saw all things in God, and God in all things." For those who go deep into spiritual practice, at some moment the veil slips away, and you see what is, and everything that is has a spiritual essence. Goddess offers us the holiness of everything. And still I rise. The previous spring, I'd planted cedars in my backyard and begun a year-long process of realizing a new feminine spiritual consciousness. It had been a remarkable year of waking up to my relationship to all things, discovering the divine within the earth. But in this year, I'd also been discovering another aspect of this consciousness. One evening, I gathered with Betty and our friend Ramona beside the lake in Betty's woodland garden to participate in a ritual. Standing among cedars, river birch, and arborvita, beneath a moon 2 days past full, we symbolically tied each other's wrists together with yarn, then asked the question, "What binds you?" As Ramona asked me the question, two things came instantly to mind, fear and silence. We wandered to private places to contemplate our answers to the question. Sitting beside the water, I thought of the fear that was never far, the deadening inclination toward silence. The yarn was cutting a little into my skin. It was somehow appropriate. Fear and silence. As I pondered the powerful ways those two things cut off a woman's journey, I thought about the book I was currently reading, the autobiography of New Zealand writer Janet Frame. Much of it was her personal struggle to break free from silencing structures and a life that confined her true female self. I remembered her description of the day she realized she was trapped. "You're so thoughtful," Mrs. T said. "I'm lucky to have such a quiet student. You wouldn't even know you were in the house, you're so quiet." "A lovely girl, no trouble at all." I had woven so carefully with such close texture my visible layer of no trouble at all, a quiet student, always ready with a smile, if the decayed teeth could be hidden, always happy, that even I could not break the thread. "Lovely, quiet girl, no trouble, no trouble at all. You wouldn't even know she was in the house." That is often the yarn twisted around women's wrists. I thought about all the yarn on all the women, how it constricted and stopped our journeys, and I began to feel an energy rise up inside me. I didn't know what to call it, but it made me want to tear the yarn not only off my wrists, but off the wrists of Betty and Ramona and all the other women, too. Finally, the three of us came together, and holding hands, broke the yarn. Then we stretched out on the ground atop the scratch of an old army blanket. Overhead, a shooting star blazed across the sky beneath the Big Dipper, and once again I couldn't help thinking it seemed appropriate. The yarn ritual symbolically captures the sort of consciousness I'm speaking about, the forceful, emphatic energy ascending from a woman's gut, wanting to join hands with other women and together break every yarn on every wrist. Women suffer. Sometimes they suffer because they're human and it's part of the human condition to suffer. Other times, lots of times, they suffer because they're women. Women have suffered everywhere in the world and throughout history. In her book, Texts of Terror, theologian Phyllis Trible documents little-known biblical accounts of women who endured unspeakable abuse and suffering because they were women and no help came, neither from humans nor from God. For me, the most despicable and heart-rending story is that of the concubine from Bethlehem. The Old Testament tells what happened when a gang of ruffians threatened to defile a man staying overnight as a guest in the home of an old man. The old man admonishes the ruffians not to act wickedly, and he offers them his own virgin daughter or the guest's concubine. "Ravish either of them," he says, "do with them what seems good to you, but don't harm the man." The men outside do not listen, so the guest throws his concubine out to them. They rape and abuse her all night long. The Bible says the next morning the man finds her lying at the door. "Get up," he told her, "let's be going." But there was no answer. And when they got home, he took a knife, cut her murdered body into 12 pieces, and scattered her body to the 12 tribes as evidence of what had been done. When I found this story, I wondered, why is this story not told and retold as a narrative of suffering and injustice? Why have most of us never heard of the nameless, raped, tortured, murdered, mutilated woman who was betrayed and sacrificed so easily because she was female? Trible wrote, "Her body has been broken and given to many. Lesser power has no woman than this, that her life is laid down by a man." One day I saw a painting of a crucified woman hanging on the cross and thought of all the suffering violated women throughout history. Thousands of women murdered in the name of God during witch burnings, little girls sexually abused, women beaten by husbands, harassed by superiors, abandoned to poverty, genitally mutilated in Africa, forced into brothels by the Japanese military, tortured in Nicaragua, raped in Sarajevo. I thought of women cut off from equality, passed over at work, silenced at home, marginalized at church. Women suffering in all kinds of ways, from the pathology of exclusion. And once again, I embraced their struggle as my own. The divine feminine symbol creates a feminist spiritual consciousness, which includes a passionate struggle for women's dignity, value, and power. These lines from Maya Angelou's poem, "And Still I Rise," capture the transformation of consciousness that happens inside a woman on this journey. "Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise." It's important that women on feminist spiritual journeys birth that cry from within. No matter what has been done to women, no matter how long we've been on our knees inside, no matter, we will rise. We will rise. We will break this yarn. The words may begin private and small, a whimper of a sound, growing until they are a roaring inside, a roaring not only for oneself, but for every woman. After it comes, a woman cannot be tamed back into silence. Poet Susan Griffin writes about the encounter of a female lion and several men who are trying to put her to sleep. They wonder what she will do if they enclose her in the room with them. One of them shuts the door. She backs her way toward the closed doorway and then roars. "Be still," the men say. She continues to roar. "Why does she roar?" they ask. "The roaring must be inside her," they conclude. They decide they must see the roaring inside her. They approach her. They are trying to put her to sleep. She has no soul, they conclude. She does not know right from wrong. "Be still," they shout at her. "Be humble, trust us," they demand. "We have souls," they proclaim. "We know right from wrong." They approach her with their medicine. She devours them. Goddess becomes the roaring inside us, the force that refuses to be subdued, tamed, stifled, silenced, mollified, or put to sleep. It becomes that which challenges and eats away at structures that cage and oppress, that deny justice and inclusion. I am talking about a consciousness of liberating action in which we work to change the patriarchal structures that deny women dignity, value, and power. Feminist theologian Carter Hayward suggests we consider the analogy of a house. If there's a structural problem, we don't fix it by changing the wallpaper. She says we must dig deeply into the foundation, discover the problem, and reconstruct the house. In other words, we must transform the house from the ground up. It is through our roaring and rising that we become architects and builders of a new house, one that holds everybody in mutuality. Along the way, a crossing over occurs in which we move from the private struggle for dignity, value, and power to a larger, more universal struggle. The cry, "Still I rise," is no longer merely personal and univocal, but a choir of voices inside us. We begin to identify not only with other women, but with all disenfranchised or oppressed people, because we know we are not separate from anyone who has been denied power because of gender, race, nationality, or economic class. Like Latin American and Black liberation theologies, feminist spiritual consciousness focuses on the divine as the liberating one who seeks to end suffering and bring justice. It takes to heart, generally in ways more fervent and radical than the church, the acts and teachings of Jesus when he placed love and justice above traditional law. I suspect nothing today would be more heartbreaking to Jesus than seeing an institution that bears his name exclude, devalue, and marginalize women in order to enforce and protect traditional laws. Elizabeth A. Johnson explains that including divine feminine symbols and images not only challenges the dominance of male images, but also calls into question the structure of patriarchy itself. It gives rise to a different vision of community, she writes, one in which the last shall be first, the excluded shall be included, the mighty put down from their thrones, and the humble exalted, the words of Mary of Nazareth. A divine feminine symbol acts to deconstruct patriarchy, which is one of the reasons there's so much resistance, even hysteria, surrounding the idea of goddess. The idea of goddess is so powerfully other, so vividly female, it comes like a crowbar shattering the lock patriarchy holds on divine imagery. Nell Morton often pointed out that the word goddess is important because it bursts the exclusivity of the old symbol and opens the way to re-image deity. Now, whenever I used the word, it caused reverberations in me, setting off the "Still I Rise" voice. Goddess became both the force that ignited the voice and the voice itself. Believe me, there is no way this word, this symbol, can be used to hush women up or get them back in line. One of my favorite short stories comes from the pen of Tilly Olson. In I Stand Here Ironing, a mother stands at the ironing board aching for her daughter to have the life she never did. She thinks, only help her to know, help make it so there is cause for her to know that she is more than this dress on this ironing board, helpless before the iron. As women, we are none of us dresses helpless before the iron, and we can help make it so there is cause for every woman to know. Healing the Feminine Wound. During this grounding time, healing was also taking place. I've discussed things that make up the feminine wound within women, church, and culture. The devaluation and negation of the feminine, the disconnection of women from their feminine soul, the silencing of the real voices of women, the loss of feminine feet, hands, mouths, and hearts. All this becomes a ravaged geography in the souls of women, a wounded Eden. Most of us have lived there in varying degrees of settling down and have normalized it as the lay of the land. But just as a wounded Eden has been created in women's lives, we can also create a deep refuge, a space of healing. In her book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Annie Dillard wrote that she could not cause light, but she could put herself in its path. The same may be true of healing. Maybe in the end we cannot make healing happen. Perhaps it is, after all, a grace, but we can put ourselves in its path. We can create a healing refuge for ourselves. The word refuge comes from a French word that means retreat. My dictionary says a refuge is a place of safe retreat, a shelter, a stronghold that protects by its strength, or a sanctuary that offers a place of healing because of its sacredness. Some time ago, I watched an episode of the television show Northern Exposure, set in the fictional town of Sicily, Alaska. It portrayed a showdown between two of the town's characters, Maurice and Ruth Ann. Maurice, a rich, powerful, conservative, ultra-capitalist former astronaut, situated at the top of Sicily's social hierarchy, represents a tough masculine figure who sees feeling as weakness. He often acts in arrogant and insensitive ways, other times in kind ways, but almost always in patriarchal ways. In the show, Maurice is planning a fox hunt. Ruth Ann becomes involved when the fox that Maurice has ordered arrives at her general store. Cast as the wise old woman of the show, something of the town crone, Ruth Ann is the opposite of Maurice in many ways. Embracing a simple, no-frills lifestyle, she is liberal-minded, down-to-earth, sensitive and compassionate with the fierceness to back it up. Now enters the fox. It stares at Ruth Ann from its small cage, gnawing desperately at the latch as if it senses its fate. So she does what any self-respecting old crone would do. She kidnaps the fox and gives it refuge in her house. When the fox turns up missing, Maurice has his hounds track it to Ruth Ann's house. There, Maurice meets Ruth Ann in the garden and demands she turn the fox over or he's going inside after it. Ruth Ann picks up a shovel. "Over my dead body," she tells him, "I've given the fox sanctuary," she says, "and you aren't coming anywhere near it." Maurice looks at the determination on her face, and knowing he's licked, leaves and doesn't challenge her again. I was intrigued with the symbolism in the story. If we look at it as a modern myth, we see that the characters exist inside us. We carry around our own Maurice, a figure of internalized patriarchy, who represents the wounding voice inside that identifies with power and hierarchies, denies feeling, and denigrates feminine values. We also have a part inside represented by the sad fox in the cage, the part of us that's been victim to patriarchal power and imprisoned in our wounds. And best of all, we have a Ruth Ann, a wise, fiercely compassionate presence who creates refuge. Of these three aspects of ourselves, the wounder, the wounded, and the healer, we've recognized the first two. We need now to get in touch with the third, the internal Ruth Ann who wants to make a healing sanctuary, who will, if need be, pick up a shovel to defend it. Feminine Pietà. That spring, after I ritually broke the yarn on my wrists, I began to create a refuge of healing. I had a dream. I am wandering through a dusty old museum looking at statues of the divine. All of them are male. I wander a long time until I come to one of those hidden rooms that often turn up in dreams. Inside is a huge lapped marble statue of a seated woman, a goddess. She looks very much like Mary in the Pietà who held the grown, crucified Christ in her lap. But this lap is empty. So I climb up into it, and to my astonishment, the marble turns to warm, soft flesh. The goddess comes to life and holds me, kissing my wounded places. The dream suggested I seek a great lap, a place of feminine refuge, where I could have my feminine stigmata healed. It informed me that I would find this healing space not by keeping my distance from sacred feminine experience, but by climbing right into the lap of it. In the following months, I began to climb more often into the lap of sacred feminine experience, to ground myself deeper and deeper within the healing circle of trees. The communal basket, female solidarity. By now, my friend Betty and I had found other women with whom we gathered from time to time to talk, listen, create rituals, and support one another. On a hot day in September, five of us sat within the circle of trees at Springbank. Earlier, we'd walked through the woods trails cutting long coils of wisteria vine with the intention of making a basket. Now we began to weave it. Betty had woven baskets before and provided the instruction we needed, but much of it came naturally as we fell into a rhythm of passing the vine around the circle, each woman taking her turn braiding it in and out, over and under, then handing it on to the next woman. We talked about our lives as women, our fears, struggles, and hopes, offering our stories, receiving stories, and always weaving. Weaving a basket is a lot like weaving solidarity. It's similar to the way women braid their lives and stories and experiences together, making something solid, real, and beautiful, a woman-made container that holds you. I remember thinking, even commenting to the others, that the vines are like women's arms, that linked together, they can hold anything. One of the most profound ways to engender energy for healing is through this kind of communal weaving. We wove our solidarity all afternoon until the sun dropped behind the trees. Somehow our basket turned out huge. I mean, huge. We laughed at the immensity of it. It could have held a large watermelon easily. The bigger the better, we said. We beamed over our basket, basked in its presence. Then someone asked, "So what will we do with it?" Do with it? Until now that hadn't entered anyone's mind. It must be true that when we are left to our natural selves, women are more engaged by the process than the destination or the end product. We pondered. "We can pass it among us," someone said. "It should go to the one who needs the most holding." So that's what we did. To this day, the basket moves back and forth among us. When one of us is struggling, she phones around. "So who has the basket right now? Well, do you think she's ready to send it my way?" And the funny thing is, it works. The basket conjures up the solidarity and support we wove that day. It reminds us who we are and that we are not alone. The basket offers its arms. As Mary Daly has acknowledged, a minority of one has little chance of survival. The bonding phenomenon among women, expressed by the word sisterhood, is therefore essential. Only women hearing each other can create a counterworld to the prevailing reality. My earliest experience of solidarity goes back to an earthy childhood event with Sweet, the African-American woman who was housekeeper for my mother and nanny to me. Growing up in the South before the Civil Rights Movement, I saw caravans of black maids driven to and from work in the back seats of white women's cars, and white-only signs over restroom doors. But I really saw none of it. On Saturday afternoons, I watched the matinee in the town's only theater, only vaguely aware that above, in the dark reaches of the balcony, were people who were not allowed on the main floor because of their color. At 11 years old, I was living inside the story of segregation without any consciousness of it. Then one day, as Sweet traveled in the car with my family, we stopped alongside the road for her to urinate, since she was not allowed in the gas station restrooms. As she took toilet paper from her purse and walked toward a privy of trees in the distance, I was struck as much as an 11-year-old could be by the degradation and inhumanity of what was happening. I wanted suddenly to be with her in the worst way, not to wait for the next gas station to relieve myself, but to do it now with her. I bolted out of the car after her. We squatted behind the trees, side by side on the slope of a hill, watching our urine cut two golden paths through the dirt. It wound down until the streams converged like two tributaries coming together to form a river. Sweet said absentmindedly, like she was commenting on a peculiarity of the weather, "Look how our waters run together." Even then I felt the hot rush of kinship with her, the unbreakable love, the way my life flowed into hers and hers into mine. I felt something of the pain of her life, had my first flicker of awareness that despite the differences between us, most of them forged by injustice, our lives ran together. That is female solidarity, the squatting on a hill in mutuality, gazing down a common slope, and seeing the way our lives make rivers together. It is a telling postscript to that story that as I grounded myself in female community, I dreamed many times about Sweet. The one I most treasure is Sweet coming to me with a gold and silver box. "Here," she said, "this is to keep your snake in." She was speaking about my symbolic snake, the symbol of feminine wisdom, instinct, and female divinity, and I thought how appropriate it was that other women should offer us containers of value for this wounded aspect. Like the communal basket, the image of squatting together on a Georgia hill is a metaphor of female solidarity. Both reminded me that coming together as women is both healing and transforming. It allows us, as Nell Morton put it, to hear one another into speech. The truth is, in order to heal, we need to tell our stories and have them witnessed. "All sorrows can be borne if we put them in a story, or tell a story about them," said Isaac Dinesen. a writer who had plenty of sorrow and told stories to bear it. The story itself becomes a vessel that holds us up, that sustains, that allows us to order our jumbled experiences into meaning. As I told my stories of fear, awakening, struggle, and transformation, and had them received, heard, and validated by other women, I found healing. I also needed to hear other women's stories in order to see and embrace my own. Sometimes another woman's story becomes a mirror that shows me a self I haven't seen before. When I listen to her tell it, her experience quickens and clarifies my own. Her questions rouse mine. Her conflicts illumine my conflicts. Her resolutions call forth my hope. Her strengths summon my strengths. All of this can happen even when our stories and our lives are very different. Solidarity is identifying with one another without feeling like you have to agree on every issue. It's unity, not uniformity. It's listening without rushing in to fix the problem. It's going deeper than typical ways of talking and sharing, going down to the place where souls meet and love comes, where separateness drops away and you know these women because you are these women. I began to meet often with groups of women, at Springbank when we stood in a circle and fed each other little crescent slices of apple, saying, "The fruit of the earth is good and you are good." Or outside beside Betty's lake, as two or three of us gathered to talk. Over and over, these women caused me to see that the circumference of my life was much larger than I had imagined. They listened to me as I struggled to expand my world. They heard me into speech and loved me into healing. On the Bridge. When winter came, Sandy and I went to a Jungian conference in the mountains of North Carolina. One morning we walked through the woods around the lake. A snow had fallen overnight, and everything was molded white. As we walked, we talked about lots of things: feminism, dream symbols, his new course of study. The air stung with cold, but we hardly seemed to notice. After a while, we came to a little footbridge that arched over a stream, and we stood in the middle of it, leaning on the rail. I was telling him something about the importance of the divine feminine in my life, how important it was for women to internalize her. He was nodding. He was nodding in such a way that I was struck suddenly by the depth of his support for me and for what I was doing. "The culture needs feminine spiritual consciousness," he was saying. He went on, but all I could think was, "Would you look at us? Who would have ever thought we would be standing here talking like this?" More and more, we'd been sharing a new intimacy. I thought of the evenings we had talked about the Ariadne myth and what it meant, evenings when we had talked just as we were talking now. I realized how much he had tried to understand me and what all this meant to me. And wasn't he the one who lately, whenever the children said he and his when talking about God, reminded them that the divine could also be a she? And wasn't he the one who'd given me the deer antlers, and not so long ago brought home a candle for my altar? But it wasn't until that moment on the bridge that I stood back and took it all in. Amazing, I thought, and I felt somehow that something had been healed between us. Silence came as we leaned over the rail and watched the water trickle by. It seemed exactly right that we were on a bridge, and when we walked on, I felt like the two of us were in a whole new place. Deep being. We are also healed through experiences of deep being, or what might be called being at the core of oneself. When we exist at the core of ourselves, we're departing from how we normally exist. We're bringing the heart, mind, body, and soul into focus and being present with them in a particular way, doing it on purpose, doing it with unconditional acceptance, and doing it with deep attentiveness. Deep being is a kind of meditation for the female soul, for such experiences provide a woman with the time and space she needs to create a new relationship with her inner feminine self and mend the fragmented places inside. How do you practice deep being? How do you go to the core of yourself and be? There are as many ways as there are women. Each woman must create her own ways, but it can be helpful to discover the kinds of things other women do in order to heal, for they show us what is possible and direct us back into the passion of creating our own healing sanctuaries. Jungian work. My first experiences of deep being had begun with Jungian analysis. Week after week, month after month, I sat in the little solarium in my analyst's house, trying to gather my soul into focus and be with it, trying to enter the deep of myself. Many times I felt like a child at the edge of the sea, sticking in one toe and then running for the dune before gaining courage to wade on in. The sessions with my analyst were like talking meditation, for the dialogues seemed to be holy discourse created for the purpose of opening the soul to its truth. In the presence of a skilled and caring woman, I plumbed my wounds, looking at the roots from which they rose, gradually finding my way toward healing. I gained help in naming and dismantling inner patriarchy and freeing myself from the old faces of daughterhood. The process assisted me to lay my hands on big wisdom and follow my thread. Most of all, it helped me forge a connection to my feminine self. Sometimes my sessions were like therapeutic show and tell as I brought in written accounts of dreams I'd had, drawings I'd sketched, and clay images I'd sculpted, writings I'd done, illustrations of the myth of Ariadne, childhood pictures, the deer antlers Sandy gave me. These and so many other small treasures became symbolic lenses through which my soul was brought into clearer focus. One day I brought in a walking stick. I'd made it from a slender tree limb that had fallen from one of the branches in the circle of trees at Springbank. This would make a wonderful walking stick, I'd thought when I found it, and I took it home without a clue about how to make one. The next couple of weeks I sat night after night on the floor in the den, stripping off the bark with a little whittling knife until my thumbs were puckered with blisters. When I finished, I gathered up all the shavings of bark and saved them in a glass bottle. I varnished the stick and took it with me when I walked. It became a cherished thing. Then one day I brought it with me to the solarium, and we talked about the process I'd gone through creating it. I began to see that it was not unlike the process I was experiencing, the blistering work of stripping away the old brittle layers in order to reach the beautiful grain of the female soul, the gathering up of the old fragments, because transformation comes not by rejecting unwanted parts of ourselves, but by differentiating, then integrating them, and finally making the whole thing part of my walk. I knew suddenly the ways of my journey, the impact and changes that my experience had brought, slipped into focus. It was one of those moments of coming together. When I teach creative writing classes, I always tell my students about what writer James Joyce calls the epiphany of a story. It's a moment of enlightenment or recognition when the character comes to realize something, to see something in a new light, and from then on, the character's internal landscape is changed. It's worth noting, I tell them, that epiphany actually means a physical manifestation of something, so the character's internal realization comes through some tangible thing or outside action. In much the same way, the feminine journey is a story unfolding, and its epiphanies come through real things, through tangibles like walking sticks and dreams and deer antlers, all of which we might miss without taking time and space in deep being. Of course, not every woman needs to be in Jungian analysis to travel a feminine journey, but we all seem to need at least one refuge of deep being where we have the ongoing freedom to tell our truth safely and truly be heard, where we can find the support we need to follow our thread, where the epiphanies can come. We need a place that will help us find the grain beneath all that bark. We can accomplish it perhaps with a friend or special group, through a journal, through prayer, or through a creative work. The important thing is to find a process that works for you, that allows you to give yourself times of unconditional presence when you can attend your soul with all the acceptance and attentiveness you can muster. The practice of mindfulness. That winter, while in a bookstore, I picked up a book on mindful meditation by Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. As I read it, I was drawn into the practice and discovered it to be another powerful experience of deep being. Mindfulness is an ancient form of meditation in which one pays attention to the present moment and all that's unfolding in that moment, both within and around one. It's known also as conscious living because the person practicing it is forming an aware and intimate relationship with each moment. I began to sit in a calm, accepting alertness for 20 to 30 minutes each day. I became attentive to my breath, noting the thoughts and feelings that arose, observing them the way the sky observes the clouds, and lets them pass through. In this way, I was able to bring attention to the content of my life as it was unfolding. Mindfulness has been called a powerful form of self-healing by many teachers and practitioners. How this process creates healing is part mystery and part grace. Somehow, in a slow, hidden way, we're able to be with the depths of ourselves, our true natures, our souls, while at the same time observing our thoughts and feelings and not becoming caught up in them. When practicing mindful meditation, we aren't striving to do anything. We aren't grasping, struggling, thinking, expecting, or wanting, but simply letting whatever is there be there and paying attention to it in a non-judgmental way. We come to terms with reality as it is, bringing all our awareness to it, breathing with it, attending it. This might sound easy. It's anything but. It took 6 months before I could sit for any length of time without traipsing off into the endless stream of thought and chatter in my head. I would realize suddenly that I'd completely lost my concentration, my awareness of the breath, any sense of the present moment, and I would have to call myself back a million times. I like meditation teacher Jack Kornfield's analogy. He says when you start to meditate, your mind is like a puppy you're trying to house train. You place it on a piece of newspaper. Stay, you tell it. Stay. But does it stay? Of course not. It wanders off, and you have to bring it back. It doesn't help to punish the pup. The pup learns by being gently brought back over and over again. From Thich Nhat Hanh, I learned a way of being with my wounds while practicing mindfulness. He suggests that as feelings arise, we acknowledge them. Yes, I'm feeling this. Then, he says, get even closer to the feeling. Rather than saying, go away, fear or anger or hurt, greet it, because banishing our feelings will not transform them. He suggests we approach pain the way a mother tenderly picks up a crying baby. The mother represents your mindfulness, your true nature, the conscious attending part of you. The squalling child represents your pain, the wounded part of you. When the pain makes itself felt, you can gently pick up the child and hold it. All that winter and into the spring, I kept picking up the child during my meditation. All the personal and collective fear, anger, betrayal, and internalized sense of inferiority that make up the feminine wound, and holding her in my arms. It got to the point that when the wound made itself felt, I found myself naturally responding, oh, there you are again, I know you. Come on, and I'll hold and rock you for a while. Eventually, the baby stopped crying. Once we get the baby quiet, we can begin to look deeply at the feeling. We begin to understand the attitudes, beliefs, and patterns that cause it. We start to see what keeps us stuck in our wounds and what we can do to transform them. Earth, water, wind, fire. Nature can be one of women's most potent healers. Simone de Beauvoir believed that because women were excluded from culture, we turned to nature, finding transcendent experiences within it. I can't say I initially turned to nature for healing. I turned to nature because I discovered my connection to it, and as a result, found healing flowing back to me. Can we say completely why nature heals? I doubt it. But the healing seems to happen more readily when we experience nature through moments of deep being. Shooting the rapids in a canoe or careening down a slope on snow skis all take place in nature, but they're not what I mean by being in nature. I'm speaking of being at the core of nature, vividly open to it, while at the same time being at the core of ourselves. During this time, I led a 4-day women's workshop called Women and Mother Earth. The last day, I asked the women to go outside and walk silently in nature, walking with wonder, with beginner's mind, as if seeing everything for the first time. I asked them to put up their spiritual antennae and seek out something natural that spoke to them, then sit with it, trying to hear its message. Finally, I asked them to bring back part or all of the object, only if moving it was possible and wouldn't be too disturbing to it or the environment. We sat outside among the trees with the sea lapping not far away while the women spoke about their experience. What was remarkable was that all the objects the women encountered were healing for them in ways that fit their particular wounds. One woman, who told us that all her life she'd silenced herself out of fear, brought back a hollow reed she'd found growing along the water. She told us that as she walked by it, she heard wind blowing inside the reed, a strange, intoxicating flute-like sound. She heard herself saying over and over, "Make your own music," until there were tears pouring down her face. She felt herself newly freed to voice herself, for if this reed can pipe its song, she said, so could she. Another woman who'd been uncovering the feminine wound in her life told us about sitting beside a spider web and glimpsing the promise of wholeness that she could weave. One of nature's most healing gifts to us, though, is its reminder to us to stay grounded and connected to the natural cycles of life. My moment of learning this came at the end of the workshop. On the first day of the workshop, I'd assembled the four elements and placed them on a table in the room to remind us of the sacred presence of nature. I'd filled a glass bowl with water, placed a candle there to hold fire, and laid a feather beside it to represent air. Then I'd gone outside and dug up a mound of earth. My pot was large, and I'd had to dig a fair-sized hole in order to fill it. When the workshop was over, I took the pot of earth back to the hole to fill it in. But a surprise awaited me. Sitting in the hole was a turtle. Since I now couldn't replace earth in the hole, I decided to sit there a while and try to listen. I saw how in living my life cut off from my female essence, I'd tended to stay in my head a lot of the time, thinking, planning, analyzing, relying on the intellect, or else orbiting the high, heady places of spirit. Now, here was this creature grounded on the earth, even in the earth, in the very hole I'd dug. The turtle, moored in my hole, created a framework of meaning that took me by surprise. I recognized just how much I needed to find my births in nature and stay grounded in them, for it is this that keeps us present in our own skin, whole and natural and awake, with our feet on the earth and our hearts wild and free. I emptied the pot of earth on the ground beside the turtle and left her in the hole. After that, I sought new ways to connect to burrow down into, the earth's slow rhythms. I began to follow the cycles of the moon, to know at any given time when it was full, when it was dark. Every day I took some time outside, where I forged new connections with the animals in my yard, including the spiders who came to spin at night, the plants, trees, and mosses, the sky shifting with the seasons. Such moments grounded me. They caused me to feel the slow rhythm of the earth, to surrender to it, and to honor my own natural rhythms. And in such awareness, there is always healing. Ultimately, nature heals because it reminds us that as humans, we are nature. We are earth, water, wind, and fire. The same cycles and rhythms that move the moon, drop the rain, and draw sap through tree veins operate inside us as well. The Matryoshka Doll and the Mother Line. The wise old crone came in my dreams one night. The first time she'd come was at the outset of my journey when she'd encouraged me to trust my own feminine source. Now, as usual with her appearance, this dream too marked a turning for me. I am walking through a country where there has been fighting and oppression. Plants and crops are dying, and droves of people are walking along the road, leaving. I'm among them, exiting the old country that can no longer sustain life, when suddenly the bishop appears, my old nemesis. He holds a stone tablet with the 10 commandments carved on them and tries to hit me with them, but he's so weak and shriveled with age he can't manage it. I grab the tablets away, stuff them in a paper bag, and walk on, leaving him behind. I come to a new country where things are growing, then to one particular cottage with flowers making an arbor over the door. Inside, I find the wise old crone propped on a bed, her lips fire red, her hair long and white as the sheets. "Look in your paper bag," she tells me, all the while smiling as if she's up to something. Peering inside, I notice the tablets are gone, and in their place is a magnificent Russian nesting doll. As I lift the doll out of the bag, the old woman starts to sing an exuberant song about being a woman, about beautiful breasts and beautiful wombs. She holds up a mirror as she sings, so I can see my image in it, and I'm struck by the beauty I see there. Then I notice I am also able to see her face blazing through the glass, too, giving a dual image of my face nested inside hers. The dream signaled a healing transformation taking place inside me. Patriarchal law, represented by the tablets of stone, was being changed into a feminine doll. I recalled that Marie-Louise von Franz wrote that often a doll in a woman's dream could be a symbol of the divine self. I thought, too, of the Russian story of Vasilisa, the girl who had been given a doll by her mother. Vasilisa kept the doll in her pocket. It acted as the voice of wisdom and intuition, helping her know which way to turn when she was uncertain. And the crone's song was a healing song, the mirror a symbol of reflection. After that dream, I began to envision myself differently, to experience the feminine not as wounded, but as something beautiful, exuberant, wise, and unspeakably valuable, a gift from the wise mother. Later, while browsing through a small shop in the mountains of North Carolina, I came upon a Russian nesting doll, painted red and yellow with inlaid wood. I admired it so long that the sales clerk said,
"I see you like the Matryoshka doll."
"The what?" I asked.
"Matryoshka doll. It means mother in Russian."
A warm, almost electric feeling flowed through me. I bought her, naturally. At home, I opened her up and found another doll inside, then another, and another. I kept opening until six dolls lay in a sloping line across the kitchen table, and I came to the core of her, to the doll at the center.
Opening the Matryoshka doll spoke to me about the need to discover herself, the feminine soul, deep inside, and to open her layer by layer.
It is uncovering the doll at the center that causes the exuberant healing song about being a woman to break out inside. Women, long denied the healing symbol of a divine being who is like ourselves, will find female wholeness forged in us as we peer into the mirror and see the real beauty of our feminine selves, which means seeing herself's reflection nested in our own. Healing came for me as I integrated images of a strong, powerful, compassionate feminine being, one who was creating the universe, creating herself, birthing new life, and holding everything in being. For me, this was the most significant factor in creating a restoration of female value, dignity, and power inside. Seeing female as imago Dei, the image of the divine, revealed now through women just as it had been revealed all these centuries through men. It was the return of my feminine birthright. Over the altar in my study, I hung a lovely mirror sculpted in the shape of a crescent moon. It reminded me to honor the divine feminine presence in myself, the wisdom in my own soul. Sometimes when I peer in it, I can see myself just as I looked in the mirror in my dream.
The Matryoshka doll found a place on my altar.
Eventually, though, she came to represent not only the divine feminine at the core of a woman, but also the line of mothers I came from. Poet Adrienne Rich has pointed out how little the mother-daughter connection has been emphasized in patriarchy. And as Carol P. Christ said, Christianity has celebrated the father's relationship to the son, even the mother's relationship to the son, but the story of the mother and daughter is missing.
The Matryoshka doll made me want to discover and celebrate my mother-daughter story.
In my family, it had always seemed to me that the line of father and son was paramount, the passing down of the male name, the male line. As the first child and only daughter with three brothers, the importance of being a male was rarely lost on me. My parents welcomed me as a girl and loved me, resoundingly so. Yet strangely, I'd had vague feelings that on some unspoken level, I'd been a disappointment by showing up as a girl, especially since I was the first child. So many times I'd heard people speak of the perfect family as having a boy first, then a girl. As a child in Sunday school, I'd soaked up Old Testament stories about the firstborn male receiving the birthright. That, along with the cultural negation of females in general and the historical imprint of preference for sons, formed an idea in me that while girls may be sugar and spice and everything nice, boys were the most desired, especially as the first child. The story I am about to tell relates a small thing, and yet it captures the subtle distinctions I felt growing up female. In my paternal grandmother's house,
were many treasures. Several marble tables, an antique hat rack, bookshelves with glass panes, a marvelous old Victrola, and, treasure of treasures, a massive roll-top desk of oak that smelled like lemon seed oil. It was a desk with secret nooks